Blog Talk Radio.
Ooh. Yeah. You already know what time it is. It's that official time. When we take this worldwide. Let's go. Listen. So now it's time to turn it up. Surf the radio waves as we begin to burn it up. We all up in your area like landscape, definitely bringing you the power slamming pancakes. It's the mandate that you tune in. It's time to move out so we can move in and recognize that this is no illusion. I'm here to clear the air so that there is no confusion. It all started off in the book of Genesis when Jacob was wrestling with who he thought was his nemesis. And when the man saw he couldn't overpower him, he touched his hip but he really could have devoured him. And from that point, then we hear a name change, rearrange the game, so now we gotta change. So I'm here to let you know it's time to listen to the Pancake and Power Slam Show. Let's go! You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show by Crave Wrestling on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to follow Crave Wrestling on Twitter at Crave Wrestling and join the Facebook fan page Crave Wrestling.
We are here live on a Pancakes and Power Slam Show, episode 220. Ladies and gentlemen, when you're live and in living color, getting funky like a monkey, if you will, we're having a good time tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And we are here live. I'm Chris Featherstone. And let's, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into the interview. We are here with former Ring of Honor star. We have a loaded show tonight. We are here with former Ring of Honor star, current qualifier for the WWE Cruiserweight Classic, none other than Cedric Alexander. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Cedric, are you there?
Oh, I'm here. I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello? Anyone there? Hello? 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 Hello?
You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show by Crave Wrestling on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to follow Crave Wrestling on Twitter at Crave Wrestling and join the Facebook fan page Crave Wrestling.
Indeed, 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 ladies and gentlemen, this is the Pancakes and Power Slam show. As soon as I get live in my studio, I get an email talking about there's some technical issues with Blog Talk Radio. How awful is that? But we're here, episode 220. I am Chris Featherstone. We are live, ladies and gentlemen. We have two interviews today. Let's, without further ado, let's get into the first one. Let's have some fun with none other than Ring of Honor, former Ring of Honor star and current qualifier for the WWE Cruiserweight Classic, Cedric Alexander. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I really, really appreciate your patience with all this craziness, man. It's live radio, man. 220 episodes, and it's been absolutely fun. But for some reason today, I get an email right when I go in the studio and Blog Talk Radio saying there's some technical difficulties, and I'm not able to get my podcast mic live on here. But appreciate your patience, and we're going to have some fun, man. Congratulations for being one of the qualifiers. How does that feel?
It feels amazing. And thank you, by the way. It feels amazing. It's one of those things that you swear up and down when you train to be a wrestler that you'll work for WWE, and after 7 years of hard work, and now that it's finally here, it's a little hard to believe still.
Yeah. So how did you get the invite? How did you get the opportunity?
I got the opportunity from a tryout I had back in February where, I was just going and just, in my mind, it was really just to assess my worth as a wrestler to see what, critics thought of me or whatever, because I was still wrestling for Ring of Honor at the time. So, before doing the tryout, I was pulled aside and asked, hey, could you drop some weight? Because at the time I was weighing about 225, 230. And they said, hey, could you drop some weight because your style really fits with this cruiserweight thing we have in the works? And I said, yeah, I'll lose the weight as soon as I get home. I'll start working on it ASAP. And from that point on, it's been a journey of just busting my butt, nonstop to get down to this 205 deadline. And I'm right there at it,
Yeah, man. I've followed you since the CNC Wrestle Factory. I actually had Caprice Coleman. Caprice Coleman was one of the first guests on my show about 4 years ago. And, and we talked about the CNC Wrestle Factory at the time and just how, how much of an upstart you were and just the potential that he saw in you, to be a mentor figure and that I saw and a lot of people saw in ROH in you. To know that you are a star, and your athleticism and just your ring prowess, and you're still in your 20s, you're still young, still got a lot to go. Who are some people that you see now and that you saw growing up as a kid that kind of shapes your in-ring style that you kind of emulated?
I got to say, first and foremost, number one is AJ Styles.
Good choice.
He's been a favorite of mine. I remember watching the match from TNA's Unbreakable 2005, I believe. It was him, Joe, and Daniels in a three-way for the X Division Championship. It was the first time that the championship was defended in a main event or pay-per-view. And I remember watching that match and thinking, I am going to be a wrestler. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And, because when I was a kid, I would watch wrestling and say, oh, this is cool. I enjoyed it. I like it. I'm a big fan of it. But it wasn't until after that match thinking, oh, I am going to wrestle now. Like, there is no ifs, ands, or buts. And AJ is definitely a huge influence on me. Chris Sabin, Alex Shelley are also big influences on my style and how I carry myself in the ring. And those are basically the guys I look to. How could I forget this? Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit are also two big guys I try to draw things from when I can. Especially watching their matches from New Japan where they were in the J-Cup.
Oh, yeah. Is this when Benoit was the Pegasus kid? Or the Wild Pegasus?
Yep.
Yeah. good stuff. Yeah, I remember him and Jericho. I think it was 90, that 89 or so that they were in the J Cup together, and or 90, somewhere around there, 91, somewhere around there. There were. Which one? What year was it?
I was thinking it was 91. I'm
91.
Pretty sure.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yep, sounds about right. Yep, I agree. So were you a big fan of Japan wrestling? I mean, you're still, what, 27, 28, somewhere around there?
I'm still 26 for now. Actually, August, I'll be 27.
Wow, 27 years young, and you got a world of wrestling knowledge already, and you just look like a veteran in the ring. I mean, you look young. I've seen you live before at an ROH show in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio. But yeah, it's one of those things that it's awesome because you've gained so much knowledge, and then you turn around and you get such a great opportunity for you. It's awesome. So you watched. So say even probably about 10 years ago, you and your team. So is that kind of like Ruthless Aggression era, 2002 or so? That's were you big into wrestling at that time?
Well, I was always huge into wrestling. I've been a fan of wrestling since I was like 5 years old. But I remember, I'm trying to think here. I think the first match I really watched that made me a fan of wrestling was the WCW Cruiserweights, when it was, I think, Juventud Guerrero versus Rey Mysterio. I don't remember. Yeah, I think it was just like a random Monday Nitro, and my stepdad was flicking through channels, and then I saw a guy in a mask. I'm like, hey, wait, go back, stop, well, let's watch this for a second. And ever since then, every week, religiously, I've been stuck on pro wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. So were you a big fan of WCW, or did you watch WCW wrestling at all when you were a kid? You mentioned Juventud.
All the time. And, like, there was even a point when at some point I discovered that WWF was coming on, like, an hour after WCW started. So I would constantly, like, flick back and forth between the channels because I didn't want to just, like, I was a huge WCW fan, but, you know, the WWF was, like, in the midst of that big Attitude Era thing. And I just refused to miss wrestling. So I would constantly flick back and forth between channels, and if I was lucky, my parents would like fall asleep or stuff like that, and I would sneak out into the living room and put that on like WWE, and then my room and my TV would be on WCW, and I would just go back and forth and try to watch them at the same time.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. Any memorable moments that you remember from WCW around that era?
Oh man, the one that sticks out in my head was when Flair handcuffed himself to the ring and refused to leave until like he got commissioner. Or something.
Yeah, good memory. Good memory. That was good.
That was actually a promo. Really understood what was happening because I was losing my taking clothes off and screaming and elbow dropping his jacket, and I was like, "What is this man doing?"
Yeah, he was loony around that time. He was quite a loony character, and it was I would just laugh every single week when Flair would get the mic. So yeah, it's very interesting. So basically, you said that is that the reason why you left ROH, because of the recruiters, because of the scouting, and because of this opportunity? Was it amicable?
No. I'm trying to think here. I can't remember. I actually told ROH about the tryout I was having, and everything was cool. And the Cruiserweight thing was just a one-time shot, for what I understood. So it was just okay. We'll do this, but ROH still there. But at some point, I don't remember the exact conversation. But at some point, we just decided that it's better that I focus on one thing and not try to do too many things at once, and we just left on good terms and said, hey, if Tom ever shows up where I can come back, then I will. If not, then
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good opportunity for you because, one, you know, if you if it doesn't work out in the long run for WWE, you know, you're a hotter commodity, and you know, you're more valuable in a sense, you know, from a business standpoint for ROH because of that WWE experience. But of course, you know, if it works out for you, you know, in the WWE, and you do get, you know, an NXT, you know, contract or things like that, I think you would be an amazing hand in NXT. I think NXT, you know, we see kind of an influx of talent going from NXT to the WWE main roster. I think it's about time to get another type of influx from, you know, the indie scene, ROH, New Japan, you know, like especially New Japan, we got Ibushi in the tournament as well, you know, and so the influx from the indie scene and New Japan, ROH to NXT, and I definitely think that you'd be one of those people that would be such an amazing hand. If there's one person, I got a couple more questions for you, if there's one person that you can imagine competing against in WWE right now, who would it be?
Well, as far as the Cruiserweight Classic or just WWE in general?
Just WWE in general.
I would love to have a match with Dolph Ziggler.
Oh, good choice. Why Dolph Ziggler?
I am just a huge fan of his work. He's I've never seen a bad Dolph Ziggler match. Never. I've never watched a Dolph Ziggler match and go, that was bad. He's just too good.
Interesting.
He does things in the ring that most guys just don't do, and like he's just awesome. I don't know how his wrist split. I'm just a huge Dolph Ziggler fan, and I'm a good fan of his work. And he's just amazing to watch.
Yeah, a lot of people give him the critique of that he oversells. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, they said the same thing about Shawn Michaels, and look at him. You know what I mean? So I don't think it's really. Sorry.
I said one of the greatest.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and, like, you know, I don't really think there's ever too much or overselling, should I say. Because, I mean, every time he does, he makes a guy look like $1 million. So you'll never look at a Dolph Ziggler match and go, man, the guy that beat him was crap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, win, lose, or draw, Dolph always makes the person in the ring with him look better than what they are, I think.
So do you have him winning this Sunday over Baron Corbin or no?
Oh, he's got to win over Baron Corbin. He's got to.
Okay, interesting. So lastly here, Cedric, just let people know where to find you and let people know what to expect for this WWE Cruiserweight Classic.
Well, you can always find me on Twitter, under Cedric Alexander. I am verified, so it's going to be very easy to find me. Facebook.
Nice.
Yeah. Also Cedric Alexander, very easy. I am also on Instagram under Cedric Alexander 1. So, I mean, that's pretty much it for social media, but what you can expect out of this Cruiserweight Classic for me is I'll probably be one of the hardest-hitting, highest-flying guys in the ring, and you can expect me to win this Cruiserweight Classic because I lost 22 pounds getting this bad boy, and I'm not going to do that for nothing. I'm coming out with a win.
Nice. Sounds good. I remember when Matt Hardy had to lose weight to win the Cruiserweight title and when he was defending against Rey Mysterio. Remember that? At WrestleMania, that was pretty funny. So, yeah. Awesome, Cedric. Best wishes to you, man. You know, I'm a great fan of your work, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, yeah, this is an action-packed Pancakes and Power Slam show, and thank you so much for Cedric Alexander. We got part one, and ladies and gentlemen, this is the first time we've done this, the Pancakes and Power Slam history, 220 episodes, action-packed, doubleheader. Remember the old NBA days, doubleheader? You have Marv Albert, doubleheader, yes! Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we have one of the legendary wrestlers of all time, one of the legendary WWE superstars, current WWE Hall of Famer, none other than Bushwhacker Luke Williams. How are you tonight, sir?
Bloody lovely, tell your mother. How are you,
great
Chris?
To have
you
tonight,
okay?
Man. I'm doing great, man.
I was hanging in there, mate.
My age
is well past my bedtime.
Yeah, and I appreciate your patience,
no,
man. And,
it's crazy. You have technical difficulty, things like that, you can't help.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right, man. Like I said, I really, really appreciate your patience and just your interacting with me.
That's cool,
during
mate.
The technical difficulty. Yeah, absolutely. It's just, you know, this show is reaches, you know, dozens of thousands of people. We're about 12,000 listeners right now, and it's great to have, you know, people like you be on the show, and just the patience that you have with just ridiculous difficulties. Like you said, it's out of my hands, and you know, I wasn't,
hey, mate,
when I get in my studio, I'm not expecting it. What's that again?
All I'm waiting for is my pancakes, mate. You know.
You're waiting for your pancakes?
Bloody hell.
Yeah, well, you know
bloody
what?
How long do I have to wait for those?
Well, text me your address and I'll send you some pancakes to go, man.
Okay, mate.
Where's your favorite restaurant to eat pancakes at?
Yeah, no, mate. My favorite restaurant to eat pancakes is at home.
Is at home? Well, that sounds good.
Where are you located? Where is the show located out of?
My studio is in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah. I'm up there very shortly for the, I think it's the Columbus, the State Fair.
You'll be here this summer?
In August. Honky Tonk.
Oh, really? Okay.
Up,
yeah.
Coming
well,
up there
link.
For...
Okay, well, that's great. I didn't know that. Well, be sure to text me or email me or call me and let me know so we can link up. That's great news. You're in Puerto
yeah.
Rico now, right?
No. I live in Clearwater, Florida, mate. I have a fitness center on Clearwater Beach, right above Hulk Hogan's Beach Shop.
Nice. So, what is the Puerto Rico area? Is it the Puerto Rico area code that you're calling from?
Yeah, Puerto Rico area code. I run a company down there from 201 to 209. And that my,
oh,
so my
okay.
I was living in Puerto Rico to 213, and I came back to the States then, and I ended up acquiring a gym on Clearwater Beach in the same plaza. Hogan's memorabilia shop was right underneath me.
Oh wow, that's great! Yeah, so that's awesome, man. So yeah, I've seen that you're still keeping in shape. Let the world know how young you are now.
I'm still working in the ring in Europe, in U.S. and Canada, and claiming the pension.
Nice, absolutely. I saw you. I think it was last year that you popped up. On the Ring of Honor show, was that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, mate. A friend of mine owned Ring of Honor for about 10 years, Kerry Silken.
Yeah.
You know, he's a very close friend of mine. And while he was there, I did it quite a bit. I was there at Ring of Honor for 3 shows last year. We were in the old ECW Arena in Philly, and then we were in Brooklyn. It was 2 shows.
Yeah.
And we did a show in Brooklyn.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this, Luke. Why did the WWE never give you and Butch the opportunity to become tag team champions? Was it ever discussed?
Well, we started. Tully and Arn, the Brainbusters, had the belts, and we linked up with them. We started a program. And those days we had television where you had only one or two main events. All the rest of them we had, you know, were jobber matches to get talent over. And we were working against a couple of guys, and that silly move we had. I gotta say it,
very simple. It was the battering ram, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know,
absolutely.
You saw me grab me in the simplest move under the sun, but it was effective. The fans loved it and all that. Anyhow, Butch grabbed me by the head, and as we ran to the guy turned, and my head hit his hip, and I cracked two vertebrae, or hairline fractures of vertebrae in my neck. And that was the second week in going with the Brain Busters. And I was out for 10 weeks. That ended that program right there and then.
Interesting. So you guys were penciled in to become champs at the time?
No, I don't think we were. We were mates. Tag team, Vince Sr. used tag teams on as main events. Vince Jr. has never used. He put Hogan and Randy together. He put the Warrior and someone together as if it was a main event. He never used tag teams. Tag teams were more attractions. You know, well, we were, anyhow, we were an attraction.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I can't think of anything. I think he put Ted, at one time he put Ted together, Ted with IRS together to work against
Money
Hulk
Inc.
and somebody. Yeah, Money Inc. He put them together to work against Hulk and maybe the Warrior. But the rest of the time, the tag teams were never, you know, featured in main events.
Was that a problem that you had during the time there? I mean,
Vince
utilized you and Butch? Like, what do you think the primary reason of Vince Jr. utilizing you and Butch? Was it like a more of an attraction type of thing? Because you guys
were one
of the most over tag teams, period. But I just wonder, I always wonder why you never had the tag titles and how over you are as a team and how over you were as a team, never had the titles.
Well, you know, mate, I don't know whether you knew, but most of my career I was a booker in different territories, you know, when you had characters, I'm going to use a person here, like Jim Duggan. You know, he's a character. He had a 4x2. He had the old flag. And that, he was over. He didn't need a belt. But to me, when I was doing booking, I put the belts on wrestlers who didn't have so much of a character, but the belt helped them get up to the level. Great workers, and lifted them up to that level, you know? And I don't know whether, you know, Vince put belts on tag teams. He had the belts on the Warriors. He had the belts on Demolition and that sort of stuff. But we were entertaining, you know. We entertained from the kids to the grandparents. And that, and we just went and ended our job, you know. So,
yeah.
Entertained the fans and that. And we went, you know, we were professionals. We didn't, you know, we weren't hungry. We've got to have belts. I've never had that expect. We're in the business. Belts to put in places which were they needed. And then we were just happy to be working there and doing our thing. And we, of course, with our character, I wouldn't be still working around. I'm still working in the ring and then around the world and in the States at the age of 69. If it wasn't for our character, you know, people still remember, as Jesse Ventura used to say, here comes the marching morons, you know, and the head, the marching and the head licking. That's when everyone remembers it. And I still get stopped and asked from that 1992, was it 91, the Royal Rumble, where, you know, I came to the ring, Earthquake grabbed me, threw me out the other side, landed on my feet, and I kept marching back. People remember that. That sort of stuff. You know,
Yeah, absolutely. That was a classic. The WWE still plays that to this day.
Yeah.
That was absolutely hilarious.
And when you look at that, look how many years ago that was.
Yeah, 25 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. So my last question to you, Luke, is when is a retirement coming up the pike? Are you even, is that something you're considering, or are you still, still going to go?
I feel if I stop doing, I've got a fitness center, and I mean, I think if I stop moving around, my body's going to lock up. You know, so as long as I can move around and that, I'll keep doing that. And I try to keep in shape. I try to keep in shape with that, mate. The days of the hardcore, now I'm doing the bushwhacker. But for many years, Butch and me was, from the 70s, we were sort of hardcore before hardcore became a name brand.
Yeah,
and
cheap
of
products.
Course now, before then the Kiwis. We did,
yep,
a lot of people
yep.
don't. A lot of people don't know that four-way chain matches, barbed wire cage matches, fire matches, all that sort of stuff. We were doing that from the 70s onwards. And that, which took a toll, of course, on our body. So when Vince came up with it, he said, I want you to be between the Sheepers and Moondogs. And Butch said to me, the Moondogs have been on USA Network. The Sheepherders have been on Ted Turner's, TBS, on and off for 10 years, from 1980 to 88, when we went for Vince, Vince gave us the name, the Bushwhackers. We created the arm swinging and the head licking.
Nice. So my last question to you is that, that's a great answer as far as the retirement, but there's another question I just thought about is that, who was better to work with, Vince Sr. or Vince Jr.?
No, we never worked for Vince Sr.
You came in, the Bushwhackers came in, what,
89? At 88. And Vince Jr. Vince Jr. started running in 84. And then I had sent tapes and tapes from different territories that I was in because I write the television, and from 1980, the first company I ever booked for was Joe Blanchard's Southwest Championship Wrestling. And then I started sending tapes in from 83 to Vince, 82, 83 to Vince Sr. But those days, all the heels were, 260, 280 pounds. Vince Sr. had all his heels were big men. And then when Vince Jr. came in, then he started changing that. So, the whole business changed.
Yeah. Who gave you the call to get in the Hall of Fame?
The office, Mark Carana, he called me in that in February or January, the end of January, and it gave me know that about that. It's funny when you mention that, mate. We got a lot of negative publicity. When they heard that, they said, "What are these two goons?" Most of the rest of the fans didn't know about the Sheepherders or the Kiwis. We first came in 1972 to USA, but before that, we'd wrestled all the Far East, Japan, and we first came to North America in 72. Well, none of the fans today knew that. They just knew about
the street. I'll tell you what, man. Yeah. I'll tell you what. I thought that it was a great choice to have you and Butch in the Hall of Fame. It did have some criticism, but I was a big fan of it, and I'm a big fan of you taking your time to be on my show tonight. I really, really appreciate that.
I appreciate
where
you being
my
fan, mate.
Absolutely.
See, any of you, my Facebook is Bushwhacker Luke. My Twitter is Bushwhacker Luke. My website, which is a new one's going up, is bushwhackerluke.com.
Mm-hmm.
And Instagram is Bushwhacker Luke.
Awesome. Luke, I appreciate
gym,
it, man.
I got to get
yes,
a plug.
Yes, do it.
Clearwater Beach, Bushwhacker, if you go to Google, clearwaterbeachfitness.com. It's called Bushwhacker Luke's clearwaterbeachfitness.com. and we live off tourism. So if you're down that way in Clearwater Beach, which is number one beach in the country, pop in and see me. Oh, we're right on the main drag.
I'll put you on the spot. Give me a 10-second promo about it.
Well, it's the only gym on the beach. It's old school gym, not like the LA Fitness or the Anytime Fitness. If you want to come and throw a few weights, the old steel weights around, dumbbells go up to 120. We've got the old school gym, but we have a lot of personalities that work out there. A lot of people from the Arnold Classic, the Hulk Hogan works out there. When boys are in town, you know, they come and work out there. So I hope to see you there. So
awesome.
Mandalay Avenue, right above Hulk Hogan's Beach Shop.
Fantastic.
Beach
Thanks
Florida.
A lot, Luke. Appreciate you on the show. Really do, man. I
great
really
to be
awesome.
Here, mate. Have a good
awesome.
Day,
Have
mate.
Have a good night. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Luke Williams, Bushwhacker Luke Williams, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, awesome, awesome time. Doubleheader, NBA, and NBA-style doubleheader. It was awesome. We had Luke Williams. We had Bushwhacker Luke scheduled for the show weeks ago. And then, you know, he was scheduled, and he made it through. And but yeah, with the new announcements of the Cruiserweight Classic, I had to promote it and talk to Cedric yesterday. And within a day, he was willing to come on and promote it and talk a little bit about wrestling. So I appreciate both Cedric Alexander and Luke Williams to be on the show, but it's not over, ladies and gentlemen. We have even another special guest. I guess you can even say it's a triple header. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk some wrestling with Greg Parks from PW Torch. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Oh, fantastic. Man, glad you're on the show. What do you think about Cedric and Luke, man?
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, really cool to have those guys on and hear, you know, two totally different eras of wrestling. You know, you've got Cedric Alexander,
right.
who's wrestling today, you know, best known in Ring of Honor, and excited to see him in the Cruiserweight Classic coming up. And then, you know, like you said, Hall of Famer Bushwhacker Luke telling tales of bygone eras. I think that's really cool to have that dichotomy on the show tonight.
Yeah, bygone era, very vaudevillian. Speaking of vaudevillian, let's talk about NXT TakeOver The End. How about that segue? I'm sure that's some people listening out there are a little jelly about it. The NXT TakeOver The End, we had five matches. Ended up with Samoa Joe defeated Finn Balor. We saw the debut of Andrade Cien Almas defeating Ty Dillinger. Revival defeating American Alpha to become the two-time NXT champions, the first ever two-time NXT champions. Shinsuke Nakamura defeating AJ Austin Aries, and then Asuka defeating Nia Jax. So, 2-hour show, and what are your thoughts? What are your overall thoughts on the end? Compare this takeover to the other ones. Is it in the upper echelon, the lower echelon? What are your thoughts?
Well, my first reaction after watching it was it wasn't as good as the other ones. And then I sat back and I looked at the card and I looked at the matches that took place. And I'm like, well, Dillinger Almas was pretty good for Almas' debut. The tag title match was pretty hot. You had the interesting development, Precious Paul Ellering coming back to seemingly manage the Authors of Pain after they attacked American Alpha after the tag match. Nakamura Aries was a fantastic match. You had Asuka versus Nia Jax, which was better than I expected going in. And you had a really good steel cage main event, first steel cage match in NXT history. So after it was done, my initial reaction was, yeah, it was okay. And then when you sit back and look back on it as a whole, you're saying, wow, that was actually it ended up stacking up pretty well with the previous NXT TakeOver shows. I think the problem with this one is, you know, it happened on a Wednesday. It wasn't a weekend show, a Saturday night show like some of the takeovers have been. It didn't have a lot of hype going in. It was at full sail in front of the usual NXT TV crowd. So it didn't have that feel of a really special event in front of a huge, a different crowd than we're used to seeing. And I think all that contributed to a little bit of a lack of buzz coming into the show. And I think that's one of the reasons it was kind of looked at as, okay, yeah, it's a takeover, but it's not as good as the others. It's only when you actually look back at it a little bit with fresh eyes and say, wow, yeah, that actually stacked up pretty well against some of the other shows as far as match quality goes.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you, Greg. I actually think that this is one of the best ones. And as far as I remember, I've watched all of them. And I think because it was just a solid top-to-bottom show. It just really mm-hmm. was to me. And I agree with you wholeheartedly about the buzz, the lack of buzz. I think we kind of got spoiled with the recent takeovers because
yeah.
all the other ones were at Full Sail, you know, from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got spoiled by London and we got spoiled by Brooklyn. And then, you know, of course, we got spoiled by Dallas. You know, so
yeah.
So the past, you know, handful, about the past handful was outside of Full Sail, but, you know, the other ones were in Full Sail, and, you know, it was a good feeling to have it in Full Sail again, kind of going back to the basics as far as having the takeovers at Full Sail. But, you know, I do agree with the buzz could have been better. I definitely agree with that. But I think it was a really solid show. I mean, it was a 2-hour show. There wasn't a lot of fluff, and I think the athleticism, I think the match quality for every. I don't think. See, here's the thing. Between this and Dallas, I would even say that this was better than Dallas to me. Just because it wasn't. It just seemed like from start to finish, it was just a really solid. Card. I didn't see anything. I didn't find anything about this card that was worth kind of throwing away. And Dallas, to me,
yeah.
I'm a Corbin guy, but to me, Aries Corbin was a throwaway match. I think that could have been
yeah.
ejected from the card as far as, you know, compared to all the other matches from the TakeOver Dallas.
I think
was the weakest match.
Yeah, I think for me, if you look at NXT Dallas, I think the top matches at NXT Dallas, if you put Nakamura and Zayn, if you put American Alpha versus The Revival, I like that match a tad more than I like the one here at the latest NXT. I think if you take the top matches on that card and compare them to the top matches on this latest NXT show, I think NXT Dallas might win out. But if you're looking at the card as a whole, which it sounds like what you're
mm-hmm.
doing, I can see where you like this card a little better because you really hit on something that makes NXT great and makes people play NXT is on a show like this, there is that fluff. You know, you turn into Monday Night Raw every week and half of the show, if not more, feels like it just doesn't matter. It feels like it's just
Absolutely.
Thrown on there to take up time because it is so long. And even the pay-per-views, there are one or two matches on there that are kind of throwaways sometimes. This was a
oh, yeah.
very tight show. There wasn't any fat to cut off of this show. I mean, it was a lean show. And that's why I gravitate toward NXT, I think, and away from main roster a little bit.
Yeah, very, very much agree there. So with that, let's talk about Raw a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was in New Orleans, and I found that very interesting because one of my favorite Raw segments in the history of the brand was last year when R-Truth thought that he was in the Money in the Bank, and it was absolutely in New Orleans. So that was very interesting that both two straight years their go-home shows were in New Orleans. I was going to purposely introduce you from New Orleans, and I'm sure that you would have bought into it and said, no, I'm Chris, I'm not from New Orleans. And I would have been like, are you sure? are you sure? Well, that's on me. My bad. I apologize, Greg. So I was going to go into the whole spiel of that from last year. I thought that was one of the funniest things in Raw history. And it was a really good way to revive R-Truth's character because he kind of did it a couple more times, and it was funny too. So it was really interesting. But, you know, just just the Raw to me. I have a Facebook Live segment every Monday night after Raw on the Crave Wrestling Facebook page, and I said last night, I said, you know, it was middle of the road for me. You know, the go home shows for Raw has been very, very underwhelming. I think that's probably the appropriate word to describe the go home shows. What are your thoughts on this, Raw?
I saw it the same way you did, Kurt. I thought this was a middle of the road show. I thought there was, like we usually get in 3 hour off, there was some really good stuff, but you have to sit through some really bad stuff to get it. And I thought that the opening segment was a really, really a perfect microcosm of the show. This was a segment where there was some good stuff there, you know, with the New Day and with the whole tag team title situation. I thought there was some good stuff in there, but I thought there were some really poor attempts at comedy there. I thought the New Day shoe thing went on a little too long. I thought Luke Gallows cut a really bad promo in the ring. And then they had the match, which wasn't that bad. So I thought that opening segment, even the first half hour, because the first half hour of the show was dedicated to hyping up the tag team title match at Money in the Bank. And you can say this about WWE, give them a pat on the back for spending that much time on the tag division. You know, you heard Bushwhacker Luke talk about, you know, the tag division has never been really an important part of WWE. And if this was a year or two ago, the tag titles would have been a complete afterthought on a show like this. Maybe would have gotten 5 or 10 minutes to hype up the upcoming pay-per-view match. They got a half hour here. So that's a good sign from WWE's end. But the segment as a whole was kind of hit and miss. And we've got a 3 hour Raw that kind of speaks to those 3 hour episodes of Raw as a whole too.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it was, you know, it was a valiant attempt to make the tag titles, you know, seeing the tag title picture relevant and the just kind of boost up the hype for that. I do agree that the shoe thing was a little off. I'm a big fan of the New Day. I've been a big fan of the New Day since day one. A lot of people thought that I was ridiculous, that I thought I liked the New Day from the beginning, and now they're like, yeah, well, Chris was right. You know, but here's the thing. I you know, I was interviewing Teddy Long a few weeks back, and, you know, he was talking about how he's not a fan of the New Day because he thinks they're too hokey and, you know, and they don't take the tag team titles seriously. I slightly disagree with that. Big fan of Teddy Long, but I slightly disagree with that because I think that they are actually bringing importance back to the title scene. I do think it's important, but I do think that the writing staff needs to kind of throw away the pen that they're using and start with another one because I think the New Day antics are getting a bit redundant. And, you know, with these microwave fans here, you know, that we've experienced the past, you know, probably half a dozen years at least, it's tough to write. You know, it's tough to write some good material that will last and that has consistency because people get tired of stuff fast. And I think that, you know, you have to kind of understand that when you're a writer, you know, and with this New Day thing, you know, it's – you know, they've only been, and it's funny because a lot of people are criticizing the New Day having the same jokes. They've only been baby faces, what, two and a half months now? So it hasn't been long, you know, that they've been baby faces, but it seems longer than what it really is because, you know, of the 2.5, you know, 3 months, you know, baby face run, but coming with the same stuff. I think the Enzo and Xavier Woods, you know, kind of showdown was funny. I found that pretty funny. But, you know, it's one of those things that you're going to have to come up with new material if you want the fans to really kind of cling on to the New Day. Because right now it's the, you know, Big E has his entrance. People are really into that. And then, you know, the kind of New Day rocks, they're into that. The gyrating WWE Tag Team Champions. So it's really kind of 3 points of their whole thing that people are into, but everything in between, I've noticed that people are starting to let go of the support.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of their stuff that we see on air is actually them coming up with it and not the writing team, because I seem to remember watching their Table for Three on WWE Network, And they were very adamant that you know, what we see in the ring, their antics, is really an extension of them. You know, they really are good friends. They really do travel together. They're just bringing kind of their backstage personas in front of the camera. So, yeah. And even watching them, I kind of get a sense that they're coming up with a lot of that stuff themselves, and some of it may be even on the spot. So they may creatively get a rough outline of what creative wants them to get across, but I'm thinking the meat and potatoes of a lot of the stuff they do is actually them. So, you know, hopefully they can adapt and they can change, you know, like you've talked about, with the taste of the fans, just to keep themselves relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that their personalities have shined, because I remember seeing that table for three. It was really good. It was actually one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
And they were saying how they were plugged in to, because I remember Kofi saying that he was hesitant about the whole thing, because mm-hmm. he wasn't used to that type of role, you know, the whole SOS character. And, you know, them kind of being placed into it, him being hesitant, if I remember correctly, him saying that. And then, you know, as the fans were into it and as they evolved, you know, then they became very comfortable with it and became friends within. But, you know, that's a good question as far as, you know, how much is them versus how much is the writers. I would say based on, you know, a wrestler's intake, based on backstage, you know, knowledge, it's a lot of it is, to most of it is the writers, with the exception of some of the bigger names. I interviewed Brad Maddox a couple of weeks ago, and he was just saying that, you know, basically everything is verbatim, you know, from the writers. You know, they write full page scripts, and I remember him saying that, you know, he said on the show a couple of weeks ago that, you know, he would try to, you know, say some things or try to tweak some things and, you know, talk to one of the writers, and the writers were really the messengers, because they, you know, everything had to go to Vince. And so
yeah.
I think at the end of the day, you know, Vince still has to put a stamp of approval on it. I think right now, the New Day, I would say that they would have a little bit more stroke, possibly, you know, because they're so over. They would mm-hmm. maybe have a little bit more influence on their own material. But at the end of the day, I'm sure that, you know, I've had many interviews, you know, you guys at the Torch have had many interviews to know, you know, the ins and outs of wrestling, you know, to know that at the end of the day, you know, Vince is going to throw out so many ideas, you know, that it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, so that's one of those things. So let's talk a little bit about Titus O'Neil. Somehow he's an All-American now, Titus O'Neil. And I have no idea why that was. I mean, you know, do you think that this was a little bit too late? Because I think if he would have came hot off the – I think if he would have came hot off the suspension right into this, I think that it may have been a little bit better. But the problem is, I think that since – you know, since he came from the suspension, since it subsided a bit, he's back to normal Titus O'Neil, who was feuding against Stardust before he got suspended. So he wasn't over,
yeah.
you know, before he got suspended. Now it's back to normal Titus, you know, who's basically at the same spot as he was when he was feuding against Stardust. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the other thing you have to think about is when he was coming off his suspension, Rusev was just coming off of being a part of the League of Nations, which didn't help him get over at all. So he was still trying to reestablish himself with Lana as a heel. You know, they're kind of doing a throwback deal with Rusev and trying to get him back to the point where he was when he first debuted and when he took WWE by storm and had this great feud
yeah.
with John Cena and was really the Bulgarian Brute. And that character kind of lost its way, and he was totally lost in the shuffle with the League of Nations. So he needed some time to kind of reestablish himself, beat on the little guy Kalisto, take the U.S. title from him. And I think he's at a point now where he's never going to be the Rusev that he once was at the top of his game. but they've gotten him to a point where the League of Nations stench is off of him, you know? So he's U.S. champion. He's built back up a little bit. I think if you'd have tried to get Titus right off of his suspension in with Rusev, Rusev wasn't at a point where he had been rebuilt enough coming off of League of Nations for it to really mean anything.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, and you know, it's and they, I think at this point they really don't know what they want to do with Titus. We'll get into predictions here in a minute, but you know, I don't know anyone who's predicting Titus O'Neil to win this match. You know, at Money in the Bank. You know, I think it's pretty much foregone.
That's okay though. You know, that it's okay to do that, and it's okay to use him to continue to build up Rusev for something important. You know, I know there's a lot of people. I know Torch editor Wade Keller has been a big proponent of Titus O'Neil's singles potential in the past. I don't think I've seen enough of him to really say that he's got that future world champion stamp on him. And really, he's, like you kind of mentioned, he's a lower card guy they're taking and putting into this United States title feud. If nothing else, Rusev gets to continue his path of destruction. He took out Kalisto. He's moved on to literally bigger things with Titus O'Neil. So if he does go over Titus O'Neil, now Rusev is a heel who's got some big wins under his belt. He's defended the U.S. title. And once he gets in line for a serious contender, a serious babyface contender, whomever that may be down the line, he will look better. And when the babyface goes over, he'll be stronger for it because Rusev has sort of climbed that ladder of babyfaces.
Absolutely. See, we saw that in the beginning. That's the reason why he was such a strong heel in the beginning. You know, within the decades of booking, we saw, you know, 20 years ago that the heel would beat the – I mean, they had jobbers at the time. So every week he would come and, you know, show how dominant he is and just beat jobbers every week. And then when, you know, the jobbers basically got cut out, he would beat the middle card guys. You know, and it's just the same equation. I mean, I don't know why it's ever been changed, but it's the same equation that's worked. It's a tried and true method. It's the heel, you know, gain a bunch of heat. You beat the lower card guys. You gain such this momentum and such this power, and then you put over the babyface at the end. The culmination is you put over whatever babyface needs to get the rub. And then he gets over, and the heel gains all this steam and this heat from beating up, you know, the other guys. And I think that's what happened with Rusev when he came in, when he won the U.S. title. He beat Swagger. He beat Ryder. He beat Big E. He beat Sheamus. You know, he went through all this. He went through this litany of wrestlers, you know, and he beat them. You know, he went through feud after feud. Mark Henry's another one that he beat. You know, he went through all of these feuds of people who seemed like they would be the guy who would beat Rusev. And they were so strong, and he was booked as a traditional old-school heel. It was so strong. You know, you had this person, you know, you had Jack Swagger, he beat Jack Swagger. Big E comes, oh yeah, well, he looks legitimate, he looks like he could beat Rusev. No, he failed to Rusev. Mark Henry comes along, okay, well, he's the strongest man, world's strongest man, he falls to Rusev. And then he gets enough momentum, you know, to beat Sheamus. And I think that this is a good way to kind of bring that momentum back to Rusev, going through these lower to middle card guys like Titus O'Neil, and that's the reason why, you know, I want more for Titus, but I realize that he's not agile and he'll be almost 40 years old. You know what I mean? So there's not much left, you know, to there's, I think the years or the times of high expectations for Titus O'Neil has subsided. But you know, he can keep that middle card role, but there's not much to expect from him, unfortunately.
And I think the one thing that we got to point out here too is we got to give Jack Swagger a lot of credit, and we joke about it now because every time Jack Swagger fights Rusev on TV, it's like they're fighting again. It just seems like that they've had thousands of battles already. But, you know, Swagger played a really important role when Rusev first debuted, and Swagger was one of his first feuds, and Swagger put him over strong every time, and that's where Rusev really started to develop his in-ring work on the main roster. And that's where Rusev really got over and propelled him into that feud eventually with John Cena that led to their WrestleMania match. So I think Swagger deserves a lot of credit for putting Rusev over and getting him ready for a guy like Cena eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we'll get that now. Hopefully, you know, we'll get people that goes, you know, him going through another list of mid-card people and putting over, you know, and putting over whoever that babyface is at the end of this, you know, at the end of this demolition, you know, so to speak, of mid-card wrestlers. Hopefully it's not an established someone like Cena. Hopefully it's someone like a Zayn or something like that. Especially with this split, I think it'll help someone like a Zayn or a babyface like that, even someone like a Neville when he comes back, that he'll, you know, he's the babyface at the end of the tunnel that you know, Rusev puts over, and it'll make him look so much stronger if Rusev is winning all these matches leading to, you know, the match with Zayn or the match with Neville or whoever. Ambrose is another one, you know. So let's talk about a couple more things before we get into the flavor of the week. One solid moment, I thought it was a couple solid moments in the show. I did like the Ambrose Asylum bit, and I did like the contract signing as well. What do you think about those?
The Ambrose Asylum segment, I think, had its moments. I liked them drawing on the history of the Shield, especially for the Rollins Reigns match. You know, you can't ignore that. That played such a big part in their careers up to this point. If you're doing a Rollins Reigns singles match, you have to acknowledge that. And I thought they did a nice job with that in that segment. I thought they got a little too cute at times. You know, this is a WWE World Heavyweight title match. You want to try to balance that seriousness with the comedy that Dean Ambrose is inevitably going to bring. And I don't think they always hit the mark in that segment. I will say I thought Reigns sounded a little more natural in this segment. I thought that was one of his better promos that he's done in a while. So I give him credit for that. AJ Styles, John Cena, I thought was really strong. I liked the idea of Cena presenting him with two different contracts. That put a twist on the usual contract signing trope, because that's, you know, something we see way too often on TV. And Styles has really found his groove as a heel on the mic. We've seen in TNA before, Styles didn't always have a lot of success as a heel. And he seems to have found his voice with Gallows and Anderson backing him up here. And, you know, that match is just going to hopefully be a blowaway match at Money in the Bank. And the announcer's hammering home that it's a WrestleMania-worthy match at Money in the Bank. So I thought both segments had their strong points. I think if you were to look at the overall body of the segment, I thought Cena Styles was a little stronger. But they, you know, they had their strong points.
Yeah, I agree too. I think Cena Styles was stronger. I didn't like the dual contracts. I didn't like the dual contracts because of this. I think it would have been a nice turn to it. And see, him saying that, you know, him signing this contract with the club and things like that, I think it was kind of like, okay, of course he's going to sign the singles contract. I think a really stronger nuance in this would have been, okay, here's the thing. You either prove yourself, this is 15 years in the making, let me do a sidebar right quick and talk about the Shield right quick. I agree with you. I do think there was some failed spots at that, but I think overall, I think the history of the Shield and having those segments, I think that those that helped that Ambrose Asylum bit, that segment, I think it helped that. I think if they wouldn't have showed anything Shield, it would have been a little bit too hokey for me. But I do think, you know, and the thing is, when he was pointing to Rollins and Reigns, I mean, Reigns got the bigger ovation. I mean, they both had split cheers and boos, but, I mean, Reigns is polarizing. So, I mean, Vince and company, they look at that stuff and they you know, kind of pat themselves on the back as far as the reaction that he's receiving. So it's very interesting take there that I noticed that when he pointed to Rollins, he got a pretty decent ovation from New Orleans crowd. But, Reigns, I mean, he's a polarizing figure. So, and that's something that's is money. I mean, that's markable to the WWE as much as people don't like that. But, yeah, but the Cena thing real quick, I think it would have been a better twist to it if the two contracts wasn't horrible to me. I think it was better than the typical physicality at the end of the match. But saying, okay, well, either, you know, against me or with the club, I would have really thought it would have been an awesome twist to it to say, here, I have two contracts. Either you can prove to me I'm the face who runs the place, and you've been waiting to go against me for 15 years. This match is 15 years in the making. This is a WrestleMania caliber match. You can go against me and prove yourself, or you can sign this contract that makes you the seventh person in the Money in the Bank match, and you can duck and dodge me like you have been doing for the past 15 years. I mean, to me, that seems like, ooh, wow, like that's a big deal. And I'm a big fan of cliffhangers, and I would have even carried this over to SmackDown, you know, as a go-home show. Like, you have some time to think about it and, you know, and wait until SmackDown to sign it, because I would have had the club come in and kind of, you know, mess up the whole thing. That would have been a way to end the segment to me, for the club to come in and kind of say, well, you don't have to worry about John Cena. You know, you can sign this. You have your chance to be in the world title match again. You know, you were screwed out with Roman Reigns, blah, blah, blah. And eventually, of course, AJ would have signed for Cena because he wants to prove himself. But I think that if you want to have a two-contract thing, I think that would have really caused a really cool cliffhanger for me.
Yeah, and I think the one downside of that would have been that by picking his match with Cena, I think you're kind of the unsaid message is Money in the Bank wasn't worthy of AJ Styles, and you don't want to send the message to the fans that match isn't as important, and inevitably whichever one he picks, you know, and he has his reasons for picking John Cena, certainly more personal reasons than he would be for picking Money in the Bank, but you don't want the unsaid message to the fans to come across as he didn't think the Money in the Bank match was worthy enough for him. And that's the only thing that I would see as an issue with that kind of selection.
But the thing is, if you're putting the contracts, you know, side to side, you're putting them both at, you know, a very high prominent position.
You're presenting them to AJ as equal, but once he makes the pick, then they're no longer equal. And he thinks the match with Cena is more important than the Money in the Bank match, and I don't think that's a message you want to send to the fans, that he didn't think the Money in the Bank match was important enough for him.
But if you think of it this way, you have the two contracts, and you have, you know, AJ about to sign, you know, the contract of the Money in the Bank. Oh yeah, it's a no-brainer. I'm gonna sign the Money in the Bank. I'll put myself in the world title picture, and then you have Cena saying, okay, well, I figured that you would do that. I figured that you would dodge me, that you've been doing for 15 years. So AJ just, you know, instinctively, oh, yeah, I want to put myself back on the title hunt. He's going to sign that Money in the Bank contract, you know, but, of course, Cena, you know, says, okay, well, I figured that you would dodge me. I figured that you would do that. And, you know, you're you know, the punk that I thought you were going to be, you've been dodging me for 15 years. So I think that it would have been cool if AJ's decision would have been swayed by kind of the smack talk that Cena, because the thing is, AJ wants to be in the Money in the Bank, AJ wants that opportunity, but the thing is, him and Cena create such a marquee match. It's kind of like Taker, it's kind of like Taker at Mania. You know, he didn't need to be in any type of title match. It didn't matter who he goes against. the streak is, you know, before Lesnar, the streak was bigger than the title match at WrestleMania, you know. And it doesn't matter who Taker went against. And he could have went against someone like a Wade Barrett or something like that, you know, and that would have been, you know, on a marquee status compared to a title match. And so you have those type of people. There's probably two or three that don't need a title, and but their matches has that big feel, that's title caliber. And I think Cena's one of those people. You know, when he brought in the U.S. Open Challenge, you know, the U.S. title was just as – it was on an equal plane, you know, with the world title, just because, you know, John Cena was in it and he had that open challenge. So, I mean, it would have been an interesting take. I just don't think the whole, you know, you can sign this with the club. I think that was – I think that it made it very clear what he was going to sign. I think it would have been a nice little –
I think you would have needed a strong announce team to put over the nuance of the decision that you were talking about. And unfortunately, WWE doesn't have that.
They have Ronaldo. I think Ronaldo would have been good.
Yeah, he would have done well. But, you know, and that's where, like you said, the cliffhanger to SmackDown would have worked better than having it all happen on Raw in your scenario.
Absolutely. Good stuff. All right, real quick, let's spend the next 5 minutes doing the Flavor of the Week coming up.
It is now time for the Flavor of the Week.
Right, there has been 17 Money in the Bank matches, 16 winners of the Money in the Bank matches. Greg and I are going to go back and forth to rank the worst to best Money in the Bank winners before we get to the Money in the Bank predictions for this year. So, who's your 16th?
16th, I have Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Kennedy. Why Mr. Kennedy?
Well, first of all, he ended up losing the briefcase before he ever cashed it in. So, that's got to put him up there.
Yeah.
You know, I think in that moment in time, it wasn't a bad decision to give him the briefcase because he did have a pretty strong following. He did have a pretty strong pocket of fans, but he's not a wrestler who holds up over time. I don't look back at him now here in 2016, pining for more Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I interviewed him a few weeks back and we talked about that. And yeah, I have Sandow as 16th, just because, you know, he was the first ever person to to lose flat out. I mean, Cena lost by DQ, but, I mean, he lost flat out, and it was just such a horrible decision to – I mean, Sandow had so much potential, but it was such a horrible decision to just plug him as Money in the Bank, and then for that time, him lose against Cena was just absolutely ridiculous. Who's your 15th?
My 15th is Damian Sandow, actually, for a lot of the reasons you listed, you know, losing and cashing it in. And the thing that was so disappointing with that is people watched that match at the time and were like, it doesn't matter that Sandow lost. He's a made man now. He looked great in a TV match with Cena. The fans were behind him. WWE's going to do something with him now. And we can look back now and say that never happened. You know, that felt like the moment in time where Sandow was really going to get a push. He got over despite losing to Cena, and that never happened.
Yeah. So it looks like we're in the same type of thought plane here. Kennedy was 15 for me for those very reasons that you said. 14.
14, I had Kane. When you talk about the least imaginative Money in the Bank winner possible, I think of Kane. You know, he's been in so many, and you know he provides a good base for guys to jump off of. His size helps in the uniqueness of the Money in the Bank ladder match itself, but he's never a guy that I think should ever win the Money in the Bank. And for him to actually have won it and then beat Rey Mysterio for the championship coming off of this, I thought was just, ugh. It was And the nice thing about it with Kane is he cashed it on the same night that he won it. So it wasn't like he was carrying around the briefcase for months afterward. At least he got it over with right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a few minutes left. I actually had Kane at 6. Swagger was 14 for me. That's pretty self-explanatory. There's no need to go further into that. Who's your 13?
I had Sheamus at 13.
Yeah. Cena was my 13 just because he lost, and I don't think it was necessary for him to have it. Who was 12 for you?
12 was the Miz.
Miz. RVD for me, just because of what came out of it eventually. It just didn't really work out. 11?
11 was Jack Swagger for me. That was a tough one because I thought when he did eventually cash it in, I thought he did a lot of good work, a lot of fun work with the Daddy Swagger and the stuff like that. But, you know, looking back on it, it wasn't as great as it could have been.
I agreed. Del Rio was 11 for me just because 2011 was just an overload of pushing Del Rio, and this was just unnecessary. And just his cash in with Kevin Nash helping was just kind of just a throwaway moment for me. Yeah.
My number 10 was Randy Orton, 2013. Again, he's a guy who held it for a short amount of time, so he had that going for him at least.
Miz was 10 for me just for the reasons that you said. Just it wasn't necessarily – I mean, the cash-in was memorable, but just the Miz there wasn't, you know, in the long run, it's proven to be not the best decision.
Yeah. My 9 was Del Rio. I think I agree with you. There was a time when he first debuted that he was a pretty hot act, but by 2011 he just – he'd gotten really stale.
Yeah. RVD was like, number 9. Number 8 was Sheamus for me, just because it just in the long run just wasn't a very good decision for that.
Yeah, my number 8 was Daniel Bryan. That was now we're getting into the sort of the top half of things, and I would be speaking more highly of these that cash-ins than the previous ones, but Daniel Bryan was number 8.
Yeah. 7, 8 was Sheamus, 7 was Orton. 4, I mean, yeah, it wasn't bad. It just wasn't one of the best.
Yeah. I had Dolph Ziggler at number 7. That was a memorable cash-in, I thought, for Dolph Ziggler. You know, he had been looking at that position for a while, and it was nice for him to get that win.
Yeah. Kane was 6 just because I thought it was a memorable time. I always have a soft spot for Kane if he finally got his moment, other than a one-day reign that he had. So that's why I put him at 6.
I had John Cena at 6. I had him this high because I thought it was important to note that he was the first to not win the world title in a cash-in, and I thought that's an important role.
Yeah. Daniel Bryan was my 5th just because, you know, it was really his – it was really kind of his breakaway kind of decision to make him. He had the U.S. title thing going on, but it was a really big thing for him, and he deserved it.
5th for me was RVD. I loved him calling his shot and using Extreme Rules as that shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Seth Rollins is number 4 just because of the WrestleMania feel too. It was a big deal.
Yeah, I had Rollins at 4 too. Very memorable.
Ziggler was my 3rd, just because of Raw after Mania was probably the most electrifying cash in history.
Mm-hmm. I had CM Punk as my 3rd, and he won twice, so I had him as 3rd and 2nd.
Yeah, I had CM Punk as number 2, you know, because of that, because of winning twice and having those cash in. So I guess, so it looks like we both agreed on Edge for number 1 then.
Yeah, how about that?
Yep. Rightfully so. I think it was great to really have that moment with Edge. It was great. It was really a breakaway moment for him to become a main event guy. So.
And the first winner of the Money in the Bank.
Yep, absolutely. New Year's Revolution. All right, real quick, let's get to the predictions. Tag team match, Charlotte and Dana Brooke against Natalya and Becky Lynch.
I think the heels early to start teasing the Dana Charlotte dissension that we saw on Raw, so I think they get their act back on there.
I agree. The heels win. Rusev and Titus.
Got to be Rusev.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Who wins the tag team match?
I think it's going to be the Club or New Day, and it's a matter of does the Club win it here, or do they win it in a 2-on-2 match later on? I say New Day keeps it for a little while longer, maybe beats the record tag team title length, and then eventually drop it to the Club.
I agree. I think the New Day wins it because of the streak thing. Let's get to the pre-show matches real quick. Ziggler, Corbin.
Ooh. I'll go Corbin on that one.
Oh, yeah. Corbin for me, too. Crew, Sheamus.
Crews really needs the win, but he's gotten one up on Sheamus the last couple of weeks. I'll say Sheamus.
I go Crews because I think they realize he desperately needs the rub. All right, real quick,
yeah.
Styles, Cena back on the main card.
I think it'll go like Cena Owens did last a couple years ago, where Owens got the first victory, Cena got the subsequent ones, so Styles wins here.
I think Big Match John, although I don't like him, Big Match John wins. All right, real quick, who wins the Money in the Bank ladder match?
Kevin Owens.
I've got Dean Ambrose setting for a Shield thingamabob. Reigns Rollins.
Roman Empire reigns supreme.
I agree. I think Reigns wins, and I think they may do the Shield triple threat. All right, 10 seconds, Greg. Where can we find you? And let us know where you are.
I'm on Twitter at Greg M. Parks, and if you're not already a member of PWTorch.com, PWTorch.com/GoVIP for all kinds of audio and coverage on the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter online.
Awesome stuff. Appreciate you on the show, Greg. Awesome time.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for this action-packed night. Greg Parks from PW Torch. Awesome time interacting with him about wrestling. And then, of course, the doubleheader with Cedric Alexander and Bushwhacker Luke. Awesome show today. Thank you so much for everyone who's listening. Until next week, enjoy your week of wrestling, and God bless. Enjoy Money in the Bank. Bye-bye.